This is Sierra Dahl with Municipal Sustainable Energy Forum, and today we have a panel of people who are talking about microgrids. Greg Lewis will start us out, followed by Larissa Dobriansky and Baird Brown. Now, Samantha Reefer was supposed to be on the panel today, but she just texted me that she is very sick and won't be able to do it. So we'll pick her up some other time. So this is Sierra. Go ahead, Craig.
Excellent. Okay. Well, I love these kind of dissertation style opportunities where, you know, Sierra hasn't really put any constraints on us. So I'm going to do my best to go fast because we've got a lot of great speakers here and I don't want to take up too much time, but, you know, the microgrid, opportunities are significant. The ability to harness local solar energy storage and other distributed energy resources to come together to provide benefits for the grid and also benefits for ratepayers is super significant. And the Clean Coalition does a lot of work around both solar microgrids, which is those are microgrids that are harnessed by solar, obviously. Combined with energy storage, and they're behind a meter. So they are focused on providing benefits to a particular site. And so we do a lot of work in solar microgrids. And then we also do a lot of work on community microgrids, which are targeted at a grid area and can be comprised of both front of meter assets, solar storage, et cetera, and behind the meter assets. So solar microgrids can be big enablers for community microgrids. They're kind of cascading, you know, levels. And so the Clean Coalition works, you know, very diligently in both of those areas of microgrids. our focus is to achieve what we like to refer to as an unparalleled trifecta of economic, environmental, and resilience benefits. And on the economic side, when you scale local renewables and energy storage and other DER enough, right, the economics come down just like any other industry that you scale. We're at the early stages in the US, but if you look at Germany, how Germany has scaled solar, for example, local solar, and 90% of the solar in Germany, by the way, is on rooftops, parking lots, parking structures. It's not out in the middle of the you know, big swaths of land. And the Germans are getting rooftop solar at about 2 cents a kilowatt hour today, right? That's the cheapest energy anybody could get because at you know, rooftop solar at 2 cents, you don't need to pay for transmission and you don't need to pay for even a good chunk of your distribution. So, right, you're really taking a huge burden off your transmission distribution, saving ratepayers tremendous levels of money, whether the policies and market mechanisms allow you to reap that benefit of you know, existing costs or not, you're avoiding future investments in those really expensive transmission infrastructure, which will save ratepayers money a boatload, right? You know, as time goes on. So really getting these you know, the economics are about optimizing where you're putting things, optimizing the costs that are required for the grid, and minimizing the costs that are required for the grid, in fact, and then also bringing economic benefits to local communities. When you deploy energy assets, you get about 50% of the economic benefits to the local communities where those assets are deployed. And that comes in the form of jobs. It comes in the form of rents. It comes in the form of energy payments staying local. And so, you know, no matter whether the solar panels and the batteries are manufactured thousands of miles away, you still get at least 50% of the economic benefits to those communities where the assets are deployed. And right now, if you're getting your energy from afar, you're getting zero economic benefits locally, right? So this is something that communities should really care about, is getting getting community microgrids in place, getting these DER locally.
Hey, Craig, could you want to fill us in on anything that you've been doing recently that's new?
Yeah, well, you know, it's some of this is a couple months old, so it feels a little bit old to me, but I don't know how many people on the call are familiar with it. But the Clean Coalition, you know, recently facilitated solar microgrids for the Santa Barbara Unified School District. It's a major school district, 21 campuses in Santa Barbara, which is in the Southern California, kind of central Southern California area along the coast. We are going, these solar microgrids, totally state of the art. They're going to provide economic, environmental, and resilience benefits. On the economic side, the school district's going to save about $8 million in guaranteed bill savings over the 28-year power purchase agreement periods. And then they're going to get, from a resilience standpoint, the solar microgrids are configured so that the critical loads will never go off, never, ever go off. And all of the loads will be maintained at least 25% of the time. So this, you know, regardless how long a grid outage might last. And Santa Barbara is a super transmission grid vulnerable region. The only connection to the transmission system goes through 40 miles of mountainous terrain that is subject to the harshest fire risk, landslide risk, and earthquake risk in California. So it's just really, really nasty terrain. And Southern California Edison, which is the utility that serves Santa Barbara region, is, you know, they've said the transmission line goes down, will continue to go down. It could be down for months at a time, right? It's just really, really vulnerable. So we need to get this local resilience. So we've got these solar microgrids. We're also doing similar solar microgrids for the city of Camarillo, which is just down the coast, about 50 miles from Santa Barbara. And we're also working on a project in San Francisco, the heart of San Francisco, that has, it's a large apartment complex that has hundreds of units that serve low-income families and senior citizens. These are obviously very vulnerable populations that, you know, you don't want to have to take these people and use scarce first responder resources to move them to an emergency sheltering, and then just for them to take up beds and other scarce resources at emergency shelters when there's a big, you know, disaster. So we're basically setting the stage by taking this apartment complex that has a whole bunch of solar on it. We're adding energy front of meter energy storage project, and we're staging the ability for the solar and the storage to work together to shelter this very vulnerable population in place. And you know, provide essentially what I argue is a critical community facility, because it's essentially an emergency shelter, by ensuring that these people can be sheltered in place as opposed to soaking up first responder resources and emergency sheltering, scarce emergency sheltering beds and other resources if you have to move them. So those are three of the things. And I know we got a lot of speakers, so I'm gonna stop. As I said up front, I gotta discipline myself not to talk too much. So I'm going to pass the baton, Sierra, unless you've got anything else you want me to say about, talk about specifically.
Well, I think that's good for now. I'm sure there'll be more coming up later. So, Larissa, you want to add to that?
Yeah, could you hear me?
See if I'm good. We can hear you, yes.
Sorry, I got to work delayed me. Boy, great projects, Craig. It'd be great to see complementary regulatory recognition compensation, you know, at the state level. I hope you're keeping your data and the lessons learned and all of these statistics to go into the databases in the regulatory venues, because on the regulatory side, that's what I'm focusing on. You know,
you disappeared.
Just when she was getting to the critical moment.
Larissa, I can't hear you. I think your connection disappeared. Or she just.
The answer to life is.
Yes. That's the way my life has been going lately. Anyhow.
The answer is 42. Did you read The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy?
Yes.
All right, Baird, why don't you pick it up from here? It looks like Larissa lost her connection.
Oh, me, oh my. Okay, I apologize for being late.
That's okay, everybody. This is kind of a weird day. I mean, I don't know what's going on, but just to everybody today, so just go ahead.
So, you know, this is a sort of a smorgasbord. the state of Hawaii took final suggestions from the parties, the dwindling number of parties in their microgrid tariff proceeding a month ago, and then asked, or 2 months ago, I guess, and then asked some follow-on question to the parties, and they're sitting there contemplating what to do with the remaining disagreements between the parties. I would say that the big step forward that was made in that proceeding was to clear away the equivalent of the Rule 18 barriers in California. So that to the extent that you don't have statutory limits, and California has a, Hawaii has a judge-made sort of exception to its rule that if you're not serving the public, you're not a utility, even if you might otherwise appear to be. Sort of like the arguments that several people made in the Tesla made in the proceedings in California. So, and the thing that's kind of open is, in principle, the tariff will allow a microgrid to take advantage of any other tariff for export services. And on the other hand, if you look at those tariffs for export services, they all contain specific limitations on ownership and on whose premises a project is located, and that just create very idiosyncratic barriers to structuring projects. And we argued about this, and it's in the hands of the commission to try and to resolve that. But I don't know how long the commission plans to take to complete its work, but hopefully sometime soon there will actually be a real microgrid tariff, at least in one state. California, we've talked about a great deal in these proceedings. I won't go deeply into it. It seems to be going sort of more sideways as it has all along. And yesterday, the California Working Group opened its first session on resilience and the value of resilience. And other people can comment. I don't know if I missed Craig commenting on it, but it, they made the subject so complex that it would be impossible for anyone to ever make a decision on all the factors that they threw into the pot, about anything. And they disavowed any intent to actually use it for compensation. So of microgrids, they just sort of said, we're just thinking in the abstract about the value of resilience. So I don't want to predict where this is going, although some people ask some pointy questions. We'll see. At the federal level, there's legislation percolating in Congress, that would presumably get folded into or not the administration's infrastructure plan. And the only problem is they've sort of thrown together everything. These are sitting in the House. They've thrown together everything that anybody could possibly have thought about, in terms of green energy for the last 10 years, and called it one big bill, everything that didn't get done in December. There are probably a half a dozen different provisions dealing with microgrids. Each one has a different definition of microgrid. And there's sort of proposals to change the Federal Power Act that are sort of wandering in different directions all within the same bill. And it's actually more frightening than helpful, I I'm afraid. But we'll see if somebody brings some discipline to it. The last thing I'll report on is that sort of away from the regulatory fronts, we are working on expanding the financing opportunities for microgrids and solar in connection with energy efficiency projects. And frankly, it wouldn't have to be in conjunction, but why not? You know, if you're going to build a microgrid, the first thing you do is sort of eliminate all the energy use you don't need, so you're not oversizing your system. Those are the cheapest megawatts to save. The 50 states, all 50 states, have statutes that allow special contracting abilities for municipalities in connection with energy efficiency. They usually require energy savings that cover the cost of the financing, but it allows a flexible procurement in states that don't otherwise allow anything, but it don't allow any kind of design build contracting. You know, they allow contracting that's more flexible and meets municipal needs. And most of those statutes that I've had a chance to work with include renewable energy in, and oftentimes, basically they're of a vintage that they kind of parroted the PURPA exceptions for a qualified facility. So they often—
Excuse me, Baird. I kept talking and I didn't realize, I guess my screen froze. Come back to me and we'll see where I got frozen. I don't know what happened. Sorry, Baird, but I'm back on, I hope for good.
We welcome you back. I'm almost done, so it'll be back to you momentarily. So in any event, some of the statutes, California's is a great one, basically says that notwithstanding any other California law, a community that, builds these generating facilities for, or has them built for them under one of these contracts, can sell power to anyone, period. Doesn't say whether it's wholesale or retail, just says you can sell power as part of your project. So, I mean, you know, there's some interesting opportunities buried out there in these statutes. Taken all together, they're great things. The other things that municipalities can do is tax-exempt finance. And what we're working to do is using this form of contracting to both finance the energy efficiency and the solar and or the microgrid, and then using a PPA structure for the solar / microgrid, or as the microgrid as a service structure, call it what you will, so that a tax investor can take advantage of the tax benefits. And at the same time, the municipality can use tax exempt finance to prepay the roughly half of the cost of the project in the form of a prepayment for energy. And what our calculations are on a sort of a typical 1 megawatt project are that you can reduce the cost compared to the capital stack for an entirely privately financed project by about 2 cents a kilowatt hour. So that's huge in a lot of places. It makes the difference between whether things work or not. So interesting times, and let's go out and get them done, notwithstanding the craziness at the regulatory level.
All right. Okay, Larissa, sorry about that. It looks like your internet connection.
What did you last hear from me?
It was a long, right? Actually, you just started talking and you disappeared, and I texted you and then I emailed you. And, yeah.
Well, did you hear the part about Jigger Shaw?
No.
No.
You were just about to give us the answer to life, Larissa, and you went, and the answer to life is.
And the, yeah. where did you remember my leaving off, Craig?
You cut off very
beginning. You were like two or three sentences in from the start.
Oh, geez.
It was right at the beginning. You just started to say, as we move into the regulatory arena, and then you die.
Geez. Okay. Well, let me just connect with Baird. First of all, this I see as the most important, actually. The rest was bemoaning, except, you know, opportunities and the electrification. But put it together a team when I served with the Bush administration to create a loan guarantee program. And we got the authorization in the Energy Policy Act of 2005. But it was really difficult within a Republican administration to evolve that. We all kind of went out on all fours, but it was grown under the Obama administration and went from a loan guarantee to a loan program office. But the bottom line is Jigar Shaw has been selected now to lead the loan program office. And he contacted me because he wanted the benefit of, you know, sort of foundational, what were the motivations, et cetera, et cetera. And I had an opportunity to ask him questions. And he really does want to try to expand this program and really use it to leverage. And I better watch. Yes, Sierra, move your hand because I'm seeing something that might mean freezing screen again. I don't know. So anyway, if any of you want information on this, he really wants to create replicable models. And this I'm teeing into particularly here, exactly Baird, what you're saying. You might, if you haven't checked this out already, he has open doors here. He said, tell all of your colleagues, I have an open door policy. And Larissa, you know, microgrids are a priority for me. And I mean, where I was in the picture, you know, on the loan guarantee program, it was all, and even during the ARRA period under the Obama administration, the focus was largely utility scale. It shifted somewhat, but Jigar's got a lot to do, but he is focused on the distributed side and creating these replicable financing models in terms of distributed resources and bringing microgrids in. And in terms of what I did get to hear you, Baird, what you're trying to do and how you're trying to, you know, combine, you know, kind of the public and private financing aspects, I think that's perfect. So I would encourage you to touch base with him. And if you need any assistance at all, be glad to help on that. That's my positive side.
Thanks for redoing that.
On the negative, however, I am seeing a lot of tension between a big push forward on the transmission end against the distributed. And what concerns me is in a siloed way, just, you know, in terms of the kind of legislation that's coming out, in terms of the discussions that I've been privy to, in terms of congressional legislation and Build Back Better. And concern too, I did take a look at the National Academy of Science, their recent, you know, white paper on electricity of the future. I don't see a good correlation and an integration in terms of the transmission end and the distribution end. And to me, this means, you know, with the big push on transmission, you can have a lot forged out there and then become stranded. And I don't think that that's being adequately addressed at all. And how you have to interrelate the levels strategically. And I don't see in any of the legislative bills that I've looked at this correlation between, you know, strategic development of transmission and on a regional basis correlated with the development, you know, higher distributed energy resource penetration in the marketplace. On the more positive side, they are waiting eagerly, I think, Department of Energy, the money that appropriations that may came out under the Energy Act, you know, 2020, December, to microgrids. They see that as a positive sign, and they're looking forward to, you know, expanded budgets because of that act, and then waiting to see what comes out of all of this in terms of the infrastructure, you know, Build Back Better efforts of the Biden administration and what's going on the Hill. The last remark I made to myself, I guess, was on the electrification. And here, in all the conversations and everything that I've been privy to, there's the potential role for microgrids here to me is just huge, you know, whether you're talking electric vehicles, buildings, etc. And yet it's not being made explicit is what really is interesting to me. The utilities talk about, you know, how the capabilities of the microgrid controller, but they of course leave off the word microgrid and also leave off the kind of microgrid business model that needs to go along with this. But it's almost like they can't help but have to mention the applicability, at least of the microgrid controller, to a lot of the strategies for electrification. So that's essentially, you know, what I said when I got frozen. There are a lot also of, I'm starting to look at it, but a lot of legislative bills arising, and others may have covered this, but I'm going to be diving into it and the state level. And I think that that's significant. So many of them are realizing the benefits of microgrids, and we're seeing more and more legislative initiatives, how fast they will go though, and you know, whether they will help, I mean, is another story.
Okay, is that it, Larissa?
Yes, yes.
All right, cool. So any comments? Anybody? Come on.
This is Vu. I don't have a comment. I have a more of a question. Is it okay if I pose a question?
Oh, sure, absolutely. Uh-huh.
So, you know, in my experience with microgrids, and this is a question of coming from a lack of knowledge and requesting, you know, more of a perspective from this forum. In my experience, microgrids certainly have the benefit long-term of resiliency and then the economic benefits as well. But in my work with, you know, large corporate and industrial users of energy who want to seek, you know, utilize microgrids in some form of that, economics in the short term seem to be more of a challenge. And the desire is to seek out immediate savings from an energy perspective. And then perhaps even some type of an arbitrage for that has emissions benefits as well. But specific to economics here, is the market in terms of microgrids, is there a lot of work being done to optimize financially the microgrid assets so that it brings those immediate savings to stakeholders in the microgrid space, primarily the users, the end users of this, right? And so one of the optimization areas that I'm wondering about is, you know, the RA construct in California, perhaps this optimization between day ahead and real-time pricing as well as it might relate to, you know, storage perhaps. I would appreciate the perspective from the group on that. And again, focus on the economics, what can be done to monetize the assets better to improve the economics for microgrids.
Anybody? Bear?
Well, the simple answer is yes. That's what microgrids are all about, and the sophisticated ones that have grown up on places like college campuses do all of that. You know, they respond to all the wholesale market signals. You know, if you're in a market where There's retail choice, and you get a retail choice supplier who basically acts as a pass-through for wholesale prices. Then you can arbitrage your whole operation against the wholesale prices. You can, as many of them do, sell things like frequency regulation or reserves or, you know, other products that are available in the wholesale market. And you can arbitrage not only those, but also the if you're using cogeneration, so you're buying gas, you know, you can look at the price of fuel and decide when it's cheaper to buy from the grid or it's cheaper to buy from, you know, make your own. And for example, the Princeton microgrid, which I've probably talked about way too many times, too many places, but, you know, they have a 5-story thermal storage tank that where they use electricity when the nuclear power plants are selling it next to nothing in the early morning hours to fill that up with chilled water and then not use electricity in the middle of the day. So they're load shifting and shaping using all the resources on their campus and even, you know, staging their buildings, you know, as to pre-cool them on a hot day rather than wait and cool them when they get hot. So there's just, and the answer, and now that's moving down to the appliance level, you know, as the smart home, smart building stuff gets better and better, it's going to be integrated down to the chips in the appliances. So it's you know, that's the essence of doing a microgrid. California, sorry, Vu, you seem to have been missing for half the answer. But in any event, the problem is that California won't let you do half of that. You know, in many states, it's fairly easy to do. In California, it's devilishly hard to do. And we've been struggling to get them to let us do it.
It's sort of ironic, too, because in California, you got the big, bold energy efficiency targets. And here, big role that microgrids can play. But, you know, ground is being laid beyond, you know, kind of the arbitrage opportunities. And he gave Baird gave the illustration of Princeton that's going on presently. I mean, you do have FERC now cutting ground in what it did on its energy storage order and now DER aggregation to at least take the steps to try to open up market access and also change the nature of the participation models within these power markets to create, in this case, with respect to microgrids, some more avenues for participation directly or indirectly. Microgrids even recognized under the DER aggregation order as a form of, you know, an aggregator, or microgrid could participate in a larger DER aggregation effort. So there are things moving forward. And we also have on a grander scale, I think more concentrated effort through NARUC to get more consistent valuation methodologies. NARUC has supported now, and this built on California efforts. It's now the new National Standard Practice Manual for assessing the benefits and costs of distributed energy resources, which in turn would greatly benefit microgrids. But so far, I mean, it's just starting, but this NSPM for BCA of DER builds upon, in fact, the NSPM that was evolved within California for energy efficiency. But it squarely embeds the New York REV order for benefit cost analysis. If we could get, at least within regulatory venues, a recognition of the need for overarching BCA frameworks by commissions, That would go a long way, I think, to standardizing at least the approach to valuing not only distributed energy resources generically, but microgrids. And microgrids could greatly benefit from it and could help with all the economics.
All right, Chris, did you want to ask a question? Nira, I see you texted one.
Thanks, Sierra. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Great. Well, just along those lines, I'm wondering if anyone knows about what's happening in New York and if there is any sense that sort of the emerging policy direction for microgrids and DERS generally is towards a framework similar to New York's value of distributed energy resources tariff, the VDER tariff, where you have a value stack that would properly value the resiliency benefits in particular of microgrids. Is that, that's certainly something we faced when we did our New York Prize feasibility study here in Syracuse. We just had a really hard time, even though the capital costs and the overall BCA was very favorable, we had a hard time kind of circling around how to properly value, you know, those resiliency benefits because the policy just wasn't there.
Baird or Larissa?
You know, very much needed. I mean, everybody across the United States, you know, this is needed, whether what are going to be the metrics, what are the valuation methods. I personally see a lot of great work coming out of particularly the labs, other research tanks, but I don't see the kind of urgency brought to that as, for example, what's being brought to electric vehicles. And, you know, what do you figure? You know, and given all that we've been experiencing in different ways, whether California, the wildfires, the hurricanes, tornadoes, you would think that this would be made more of a priority. And I think there is sufficient work that at least the labs have done. I've seen it particularly with respect to Sandia Lab, where you could begin to at least even have something to start with, approximations or proxies. And I think things should concretely start forward. And also, I mean, that's the focus, you know, in the microgrid tariff proceeding in California. And it's raised all the time, the need for the resiliency, but I don't see the steps forward. Baird, you know, what is happening there on the microgrid tariff?
You're muted, Baird.
You're muted, yes. Baird, you're muted.
Or Craig, you know, are they taking any concrete steps?
Go ahead, Barry.
Larissa, sorry, I was muted. You missed when I was talking earlier. I sort of gave the latest on the value of resilience discussions, which are just underway in the California Working Group. And they have made it so complicated in the first day's session that I doubt we'll ever untangle our way out of it in the course of the next couple of months they've allocated for it. But we'll see. And they disavow any intent to actually turn it into actionable tariff pricing.
Charlie Holland, you had your...
Yeah, thanks. I apologize. I apologize for joining late. I think I missed a great discussion. I've got two related sort of questions or points, both premised on this issue that at least for the last 4 or 5 minutes we've been talking about, which is role of regulation in either encouraging or impeding the full suite of values that a microgrid can bring to the world. So my first question is, I apologize if it's already covered, I'll listen to the recording or whatever, but to what extent do Baird or I guess Larissa think that once the ISOs have adopted approved plans under FERC 2222 and 222A, and therefore, and states won't be able to opt out of a particular plan on a particular ISO plan. My first question is, to what extent will that make some of these issues go away? And any thoughts on that? And then second related point, am I correct that however you think that society should value resiliency, that the fit for the right level of government to do so is the state or the local, as opposed to the ISO, which is to say, are we stuck in what, Baird, you just said is, you know, California complexity, because that's where you're going to somehow put a policy value on resiliency. So two questions, FERC 2222 and impact and relative level of government to be the right level, lever. That's my question.
So let me respond in backwards order. First of all, there's a tension between, I don't say conflict's too strong a word, but a tension between having markets for individual services that are valued by the market. And, you know, 2222 is really heading in the direction of having open markets for everything at the wholesale level, where if a microgrid can provide a service, it gets the market price for the service. And the idea of having a value of resilience or a value of microgrids, even more so, that sort of throws everything into one pot and doesn't, you know, runs at least a risk of, fudging it at all the corners and creating a non-market price for almost everything. So both approaches are clearly being undertaken by various folks. But what I was saying about California was they seem to be taking the former, the latter approach, and it's going to go, they're going to go nuts. On the other hand, Lorenzo's on the line and he would be more articulate than I am, but you know, the value of a service at the wholesale node may be rather different than the value at a distribution interconnection. The microgrid may be either solving a local problem at the substation, or it may be causing a local problem at the substation, depending on the circumstances. And so in a great new world, you'd have an intermediate level where the RTO is optimizing at the RTO level, the distribution company is optimizing at the distribution level, and the microgrid is optimizing at the behind the point of common coupling level.
Yeah, the hyper local right next to the floodway or something. Interesting.
You know, with the 2222, number one, I don't know whether we're going to see anything go faster on resiliency as such. I mean, they're evolving in terms of, scarcity pricing, resource pricing. But even though the states can't opt out, there are so many ways in which they could literally obstruct this push to open up the markets further through the order 2222. I think 2222 I would characterize as an enabling order. It opens up opportunities, but they await significant working out between the two levels. And I think maybe in the easy areas that will be worked out, where transactions at the wholesale level and concerns and issues at the distribution level will be viewed as compatible. But there are a lot of areas in which there will be tensions. And within the order 222, it expressly does give the states, either through the regulator or the utility distribution company, different avenues to block things. they could. I mean, it's supposed to be reasonable, but they have that opportunity. So don't view the 2222 as some kind of silver bullet, no less a solution to resilience. But on the other hand, there are accompanying things that are moving here, and like in hybrid products, okay? And I see a lot of potential there that for microgrids, and if they can develop some new products and here differentiate systems functions versus like individual or combinations of DIRs, and they're looking at that through hybrid product development, you know, at the wholesale level, that can contribute some benefits here, as well as, of course, they're looking at the wholesale level, how to be more compatible with the states in terms of carbon pricing. But there is just much, I'd have to say, to be worked out. So don't look for any easy solutions more quickly. But the silver lining I see on all of this is that what the FERC level has done is put great pressure on the states to have to answer up on market solutions, which they have been dragging their feet throughout. And with all the talk about like transactive energy, they are not putting into place the capabilities to even grow really new retail markets. But with this now push from the wholesale level and in terms of the order and the framework that it constitutes, it really does put the pressure here to try to get the states to work together with the RTOs, ISOs to try to find some solutions. And it does certainly put market-based solutions squarely on the radar screen, where otherwise the states would be dragging their feet as they have been in the past.
Yeah, let me add, you know, in some fairness to the complexification that's gone on in California's discussion, there's a fourth level of optimization, which is communities, you know, are probably the best judge making political decisions about the, you know, what is resilient for their community. And the hope on my part would nonetheless be that you'd still find a framework in this sort of each one optimizes their own scenario that allows local decision making to, you know, be based on all the value signals that they're getting from those other levels, plus their political decision making, and you know, they can be the procurer of some of the microgrid or other solutions, and make that decision local and at least less complex than if you try and have an integrated decision about all of it, which is where the California Commission was leading yesterday and left my head spinning.
All right, Lorenzo, you have your hand up.
Yeah, thanks. I definitely agree with Larissa's point that FERC Order 2222 has really pushed a kind of conversation that wasn't happening before nationally. It's happening in all the RTO and ISO areas, and not just in the US even. They're talking about it in Texas, and they're talking about it in Ontario.
So Texas isn't part of the US, is that what you're saying?
Well, it's not regulated by FERC. You know, they're not under FERC regulation, so it's not part of the U.S. in that sense. Ultimately, the value of distributed resources, I don't believe, is going to come from them participating in wholesale markets. The wholesale market discussion gets a lot of this coordination conversation going, which is absolutely necessary. But the value, and I put a link in the chat to this paper by Christopher Clack, where he co-optimizes the whole systems using investment investment type models for decarbonization. And one of the things that that we can start to realize, you know, the concerns about the operational impacts of renewables because they depend on the weather and they're so-called intermittent. And how do you balance them? And we see parties saying, well, we've got to keep gas plants around in order to balance the renewables and so on. Well, what we can do with distributed resources is essentially balance all the solar locally, balance the rooftop solar locally, have massive amounts of it, but combined with storage so that what we're aiming towards really from a whole system operational perspective is that net load at transmission distribution interfaces ought to be close to flat, in which case you don't need massive resources, fossil fuel resources to balance renewables. You don't need massive upgrades on transmission. And so, you know, a system that's really what I call bimodal, where you have now an active participatory distribution side to complement the bulk system is really the way we need to think from a whole system perspective. The problem is that, or one problem is that the values of distributed resources on distribution system don't exist in a quantitative compensatory way. And for the most part, the rules don't allow them. They're in the way. And so a lot of what this comes down to, in my opinion, is simply we've had 100 years of centralized top-down control where all the big money is in building big assets and getting monopoly regulated rates of return on those assets. And the incumbents who are benefiting from that don't want to give it up. I one of the ways I'm thinking about this is, you know, we talk about democratization of energy. We talk about environmental justice and equity. Let's give those terms concrete meaning. What does that really mean? I think there's too much of the conversation where people like to say democracy, but they don't really mean it. You know, and this goes to what Baird was saying a moment ago, that we need something that's top down meets bottom up. We need the needs to be defined, the needs for resilience, the priorities, the local economic benefits, those needs to come up from the bottom, but policy from the top to allow it to happen without preempting it, without stifling it. And in California, we've got a law in the legislature this year, Senate Bill SB 99, called Community Energy Resilience Act, which would essentially provide a program under the Energy Commission to fund local governments and provide technical expertise at the local government, community, tribal authority level to design their own resilient electricity resources and systems to meet local resilience needs, empower the communities to do that. I'd like to see that go national, build it into a National Infrastructure Act where we're going to have a program that would fund through the states or directly to local governments, the ability to plan for local resilience. To me, the big lesson from Texas is we shouldn't be 100% dependent on the grid. And I don't care whether we have a complex valuation methodology for resilience like the PUC is working on, and I give them credit for their ambition in trying to do such a thing, but really it's obvious the grid is going to fail no matter how many billions of dollars we invest in it. There'll be times when it fails and people die. And so we just shouldn't be 100% dependent on it. Nature doesn't design resilience by having one centralized bulk system that does everything. So let's really start to recognize the need to build resilience locally.
Okay, Chris Carrick. You have your hand. Go ahead.
Well, I just put my comment in the chat, really. I just agree with that completely. I mean, when we were doing our feasibility study, NYSERDA was asking us to come up with a meter-like tariff mechanism, which was not in the scope of our work, and I'm not really qualified to do that on my own. So, you know, we defaulted to a wholesale sort of scenario for our county's waste-to-energy facility, but it really wasn't enough. It wasn't the right way to go at all. So I just wanted to support those comments. Thanks.
Hey, this is Craig, and I just want to, you know, reinforce those comments as well. And earlier I had put in a, into the chat, a value of resilience proposal that the Clean Coalition is working on. There's an article, a very colorful article that I recently penned last week or the week before. And the link to that article is in the chat. So people want to read what the Clean Coalition is promoting. Yeah, I'd love to hear your feedback. So it's the article link is there.
Hey, Craig, what Lorenzo said, that SB 99, it sounds like back to RESCO. But just quickly here, I also buy into exactly Lorenzo, what also Baird has said. I think, though, one thing I just add to that is that it tells me we do need to address this outside of the utility prism. We've got to bring the community interest to the table, and you got to have vehicles here for the community to have a voice and to make a difference. And that we can't just look at this in terms of electricity infrastructure. We've got to look at it in the larger context of community built environment and energy infrastructure and cost effectiveness across the board. And looking at it also in terms of, you know, energy security, physical and cybersecurity. And that would all seem to weigh into getting out of the just solving everything through the electric sector, but looking at it in the wider universe of energy infrastructure, community built environment.
Okay, Bob Perry, you have a comment, and this will be the last one. I want to say one thing before Bob talks, though. We have community distributed generation that Lynn Arthur is going to be discussing tomorrow. So it's a different approach to CCA. So that might be of interest to some of you, I would assume so. And the other thing is, on a personal note, I am moving, hopefully. So we're going to have the next calls at the end of June to give me some time to get everything figured out.
So, good luck.
Yeah, no, it looks like it. Hopefully. Bob Perry, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I just want to tag on to what everybody else has said and what Lorenzo has said. And I think that, you know, a big problem is that we're trying to justify distributed energy economically using outdated paradigms. I mean, right now, if you're a microgrid developer, the utilities are telling you, you can build your microgrid, but you still got to pay all these grid access charges and as though you were fully reliant on the grid. And that in order to really make these the return on these investments, we really need to change to a model that really you only pay for what you actually use. Now, Craig and Clean Coalition has been beating this drum for quite some time on the transmission access charge. And this is something that really needs to happen. I think another thing that people need to realize, or that another kind of a foundational concept, is energy resilience has a geometric relationship to the distance between generation and use. And the minute you start sending that energy out, the resiliency will drop. So there needs to be a value and an incentive to keep energy use as local as possible. And this kind of portends to the FERC order 2222, is that, you know, we need to keep these resources as local as possible. And that speaks to what Lorenzo said as far as distribution systems basically leveling out. So there's just some real structural issues that have to be redefined, I think, before we can go forward.
Okay, well, that's it for today, guys. We're hopefully to see you tomorrow. It should be an interesting conversation. And thanks for coming, and thanks to our presenters. And I know everybody's got to get off to their next meeting. So we'll talk to you then.
Thanks a lot, Sierra.
Good stuff. Really appreciate it.